Welcome to Inside Impella, Transport Talks, your co-pilot for training. I'm Shane Turner, and I'm so glad you're here. As members of Abiomed's Critical Care Transport Team, we know that every transport is a lifeline, and every moment counts in our mission to recover hearts and save lives. Often, we're lucky to collaborate with specialists to ensure we can best support our patients, and today is no different. We're joined by Nancy Jaworski, an advanced practice nurse with extensive experience in adult congenital heart disease, to learn about challenges and innovations shaping heart failure care today. Nancy will share her insights on the subtleties of diagnosing this often misunderstood condition and the critical role of transport providers in managing such complex patients. Let's talk. All right. Well, welcome back. Today we have our special guest, Nancy, with us. Nancy, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Nancy Jaworski, and I am a nurse, advanced practice nurse by training. I've spent the better part of the last three decades caring for children with life-limiting illnesses, exclusively in the last decade that has been children and young adults with heart failure. Either needing mechanical circulatory support or a transplant just close monitoring to make sure that we are optimizing their quality of life while we see what that heart failure journey looks like for them. And then about a year ago, I got a great opportunity to join Abiomed, where I can help not just one kid at a time or one young adult at a time, or even actually now with congenital heart patients living into their, I met a 78-year-old last week. I get to help this entire population find ways to recover from things that give them setbacks in their heart failure, or help them bridge to the next advanced therapy.
It's a very interesting journey. You know, and when you and I were meeting to discuss the recording this episode, you know, you said something that really had never crossed my mind, because I too dabbled in pediatrics for a little while. I worked for a children's hospital, and we saw these congenital heart kids, but you made mention that so many more children are surviving now because the procedures are so much better, that you're seeing congenital heart kids now be congenital heart adults, right? And in this setting of that, where you and I work now with mechanical circulatory support, we've got to navigate some unique structural changes with our device, don't we?
100%. So for the first time ever in the history of the world, I suppose, there are more adults now with congenital heart disease than there are children. And if a child is born with a congenital heart disease, that first year is kind of their biggest risky year. But if they survive through that first year, which about 85% do, that their chances of living a relatively normal lifespan increase to 93% after the first year. And so we have lots of adults that now have a congenital heart disease that has been treated in some form or fashion as a child. And now they're going to live long enough to have normal age and lifestyle related, also heart issues, right? Coronary artery disease, they're going to have the normal things that the rest of us have, diet and sedentary lifestyle issues, right? So they're going to have all of these normal age-related things on top of the fact that they have this congenital issue, which they either have atypical anatomy or atypical physiology. And so how that will play into either how they develop heart failure or how we treat their heart failure, That's the piece of the science that is evolving now. And I'm super excited about it, because when I was first a nurse, like, we didn't have all these options to offer people. And so often these patients would either die in childhood or as a young adult. And now we don't have to tell the moms that. I mean, granted, that's the issue for some people, but not for everybody. I think the other thing that is super cool about this is that never before have we had this opportunity where engineers and scientists and healthcare providers and the patients and families are like all collaborating together to kind of move this bar forward. And so it's super exciting to me to be able to be part of that solution.
Yeah, I too feel really blessed working in such a unique environment and having so many resources and multiple disciplines coming together for the collective care team. And, you know, so for the spirit of this episode, we've danced around a couple different topics here, but I think you hit the segue really hard here. You know, the scope of this conversation, it's not pediatrics. Like, there may be some things maybe in the future that we could come back and circle back to, but really today we're here to talk about heart failure. You know, and specifically, okay, you have a passion for right heart failure. So in the setting of our audience, which are majority transport providers, like, let's start with a high-level overview. So what are your thoughts around right heart failure? And why is it this mysterious condition, do you think?
Well, first of all, transport providers, I mean, I've done a lot of scary things in my career, but transport, that's the Wild West. Right. Every time I think about that, I think about somebody like, you get this patient, you get in some kind of a transport mechanism, and then it's just you and the patient until you get from point A to point B. And so, I mean, talk about, you got to think on the fly. And the thing about right heart failure is it's so tricky. It's so sneaky. The problem is sometimes is that you don't know you have right heart failure until you know you have right heart failure. Like, it kind of sneaks up on you, because when you have left heart failure, it is usually relatively apparent very quickly, because that is the output to the body. And so the body starts to show you, particularly in adults, that you have a problem, right? Adult patients become hypotensive really very quickly, because they don't have any cardiac output, right? And they will increase their heart rate, but they have the ability to do it over a long period of time. And so you will see changes in their perfusion to their body. You will see a change in their blood pressure. They may even look kind of not super with it. But right heart can be sneaky in the fact that because it's so dependent on the other mechanisms in the body, you might not see that decrease in, for instance, oxygenation right away, right? Because they're still getting blood over to the left heart. It hasn't stopped. It's just dysfunctional. So you've still got oxygenated blood that has come back from the lungs. It's going over to the left heart and going out to the body. So it can be tricky. And I think a lot of our traditional mechanisms for treating shock, bleeding, that kind of things, we focus on increasing output, right? We just need to get the blood out of the heart to the body. And we sometimes get so focused on that. So for instance, we turn up inotropes, right? We turn up drugs to get the heart going, pump the blood out to the body. And we get so focused on that, that we forget that we have these other pathways that are going to eventually come back to haunt us. In other words, you do have to have a mechanism to get the blood back to the heart, right? So, and you also have to, at some point, get that blood from the right heart to the left heart. And again, that can be happening at a decreased rate over a period of time, and you aren't aware that you're not getting that preload from the right heart to the left heart until, like I said, until it's very apparent that you have a problem. The left heart is unique in that it's very musculature, so it will tolerate being dilated for a short period of time pretty well, and those valves will stay functional. But the right heart, if it gets dilated at all, in other words, if you've been increasing cardiac output, but you've got some right heart dysfunction that you aren't super aware of, and that right heart begins to kind of get a little fluid overloaded, volume overloaded, that tricuspid valve will dilate very easily because the right heart isn't muscular. And then what do? How do you get it decompressed? You can't. You can't really. So you have to think about, how can I impact the load going to that right heart without actually taking away my cardiac output from my left heart, or without without advanced therapies when you're when you're on the bus, so to speak, right? When you're in whatever transport vehicle that you are.
So what I'm hearing, though, is that a lot of providers almost get surprised when they realize there's a right heart failure component. But, you know, if we tap into our knowledge of heart failure, I think almost universally, even if you don't have a cardiovascular background, most people remember somewhere in their initial education that the number one cause of right heart failure is left heart failure. So if we're dealing with these patients who have a known left dysfunction, we should almost suspect right heart failure, right? Like, what's coming to mind here for me is, so I have a blended background, but a majority of my professional career, I was in the fire service. So I was a medical professional. I was a paramedic as well. Well, there was a well-known speaker in the fire service that went on this talking tour, and he talked about how firefighters shouldn't be surprised when the house is on fire. That's why you're going there, right? And his analogy he gave was, when the trash man comes around the corner and sees trash on the corner in front of your house, he doesn't lose his mind and get freaked out because he expected it, right? And the analogy there was, these firefighters should expect the house to be on fire. And that's kind of what I'm applying here, is like, if we're dealing with a patient with left heart failure, we should almost be surprised that we didn't come across a right component. Like, we should almost be expecting some degree of RV dysfunction too.
Correct. You should assume that you have at least RV dysfunction, right? Because sometimes, and even if they had an echo kind of before they left, right? So somebody took a look and said, oh, nope, this left heart is in trouble. It looks very sick, but this right heart is fine. It may look fine because the septal wall is not working very well either, right? And so you're not getting a ton of bowing, or it still looks like it's beating, but that's because the left heart also looks bad. So cardiologists across the board tell me that diagnosing right heart failure on echo is extremely subjective, because the measurements of right heart, how the right heart looks, are so dependent on the left heart function. So if your left heart isn't functioning very well, it can make it look like the right heart is doing fine. So for instance, when I used to work at the bedside, and we would put in an LVAD in patients, I always went into those cases expecting that we would unroof right heart failure, right? That right heart would look way worse once we kind of fixed the left heart with mechanical circulatory support. And part of that is too, think about it. When you have fixed something on the left side, so you have left heart failure and you are fixing something, whether that is with drugs for contractility, whether you have replaced volume for preload, whether you have afterload reduced them so that you don't have that systemic vascular resistance, you now are, this heart may have been a situation where the right heart was functioning well or okay, because it wasn't getting a full load. It wasn't getting full volume. It wasn't getting a full demand placed on it. So now whatever you have done that has corrected what's happened on the left heart, you now, this right heart is getting a full load. We are getting a full demand on it. And it says, nah, I haven't been doing that for all day, so I'm not going to do it now. Or I haven't been doing that for 2 weeks or 2 months, right?
Right, right.
So you need a mechanism. You need to have a strategy to say, okay, how am I going to give this right heart a chance to be like, come on, dude, let's do this. You can work.
And even before we get to the point to figure out what specific treatment package we need to provide, you know, historically, and like you said, so ultrasonography, very subjective findings. You get the echo there, what one physician may call dysfunction moderately, one may call minimally on the other, right? But in the absence of these advanced diagnostics, because we haven't even got into all the blood markers and different other tests we can run, right? And pressures and invasive hemodynamic monitoring. In the absence of all that, all you may have is just kind of a meh clinical presentation. And you just have to have that suspicion to go with it and say, I'm going to assume there's probably some RV dysfunction here. And then let's prove me wrong later, but let's be safe in the interim. Because that's where transport providers find themselves most often is I have a mile wide working differential diagnosis and I get little clues as I go. You know, the sending facility has kind of planted the seed with this LV dysfunction picture and I've got a yucky looking EKG and I've got some hemodynamics who are kind of labile. But as you pick up more clues, and some of them may just be provider intuition, right? You're like, they don't look quite as good as they should if this is their only problem. Let me at least include some right heart stuff as part of my working diagnosis.
100%, right? They should be, first of all, nobody in transport is ever stable. Really?
I'm so glad you said that. I have removed the word stable from my vocabulary, and I call it a win when they're consistent. I got rid of the word stable, right? But they're consistent. Right. I can settle that makes me happy.
Yeah, because the reason they're being transported, not via the family car, is because they need some sort of support, right? So they're never stable. And again, you should consistency, right? And you know, for lack of a better term, I used to say not dead.
Hey,
because
and sometimes that's the win, right? They didn't arrest on me, so that's a win.
Yes, and you don't have to always be we don't need a perfectly normal blood pressure. We just again need one that's consistent, right? Maybe your MAP is 60, but we're 60 and we've been 60 and we've been 60. So I'm gonna take that. We have some perfusion, we have some oxygenation, right? And so, because when you push either side of the heart, sometimes again, that's where you're going to get into trouble, because once that tricuspid valve has dilated, once the right heart has failed enough that you really start to get that septal bowing, you don't know it. But what's going to happen is you are going to lose your preload. And that's going to be one of your kind of sneaky indicators, right? You're probably not going to have a heartline. You may have a heartline. You might have a CVP in transport. Who knows? Who knows what kind you're going to have? But you're for sure going to be looking at their blood pressure. And so if you're for sure going to have things available to you, like, you can give volume, right? So, but if volume only works, if your blood pressure drops and volume only works for 3 minutes and then they actually look a little worse, you have right heart failure, 100%.
It's almost how you would approach, you know, back to your previous life with these congenital babies, is you try a therapy that you suspect could work. If it makes them worse, then you stop, right? Like, so you have this baby that has, you know, alternate anatomy and physiology. Well, they're hypoxic. Mm-hmm. I think they need oxygen. Well, oxygen made them worse. Okay, don't do oxygen anymore. You know, and same thing here, right? I suspect right heart failure. They're hypotensive. Let me try volume. Maybe they're intravascularly depleted. Oh, no, no, wait, they got worse. Okay, well, then it's not a volume and a pipe issue. Mm-mm. It's a pump issue, right?
It's a pump issue, yeah. Same thing with, like, tachycardia, right? So if somebody is tachycardic enough, they will lose their fill time, right? So, do they need to be sleepier? So, like, you know, calm down. Why are they tachycardic, right? Are they trying to maintain their cardiac output? So maybe you do need to turn up the epi. Maybe you do need to, you know, turn up their drugs and you wait. And so sometimes when I used to run, and my office and my clinic was in a different space was in a different building than the ICU. And so sometimes I would get a call from the ICU and they would describe a scenario to me. They're like, we've given 20 per kilo of volume. And, you know, they get better for a while. But then they get a little bit worse. And now, in this patient, again, they would have had a ventricular cyst. They're like, so we turned up the RPMs. And then they got a little bit better, but then they looked worse. And I was like, turn it down. Turn down the RPMs. And they're like, no, they need the output. And I was like, turn it down. So when you have a device in place, I can actually adjust their tachycardia, so to speak, right? Because that's their output. But so if they're so tachycardic, they're going to not fill, so then you're going to have a preload issue in your right heart, right? You're going mm-hmm. to eventually run out of volume. Mm-hmm. So I used to always talk with the ICU guys about, you have to think about, how can I impact preload and afterload when I have a non-functional pump, right? So again, heart. So how do you affect afterload when you have a non-functional pump? Well, again, we have to go after things like, are they too tachycardic? How do I get blood back to the body? Is their blood pressure, are they vasoplegic, right? Do they have no blood pressure? So you have to think about, do they need a little squeeze? Nobody loves norepinephrine, but sometimes you need a little squeeze, because you just do. Or how do you affect preload? Again, you might just need to give the left heart some time to fill. You might need to give the right heart some time to empty. You can't, that right heart is weak, you can't push it.
Right. And again, in all these situations, it's almost like process of elimination in mm-hmm. transport, because, you know, yep. again, I don't have a team of 10 experts to bounce ideas off of. I don't have a myriad of labs and tests and diagnostics that I can comb Correct. Through. I'm in the moment, and the patient is probably an extremis or approaching it. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to yep. ward off evil spirits. And exactly what you're saying, like, I'm going to try this because it makes sense if this is the problem. Well, that didn't work. Okay, well, then that's not the problem. So let's do this to see if this makes sense for what I think the problem is. Ooh, they got better. Okay, well, let's stay on that path right now until it doesn't yep. work. You know, and that's yeah. how a lot of transport providers train. And that's how they kind of program alleviate the
that's
stress.
So
they are. There are some impressive people. But you have to have a plan A and a plan B. And then you also have to have Charlie and Delta and Echo and Foxtrot and 6 or 7 other options, because you don't know what's about to change. You know, I would, I felt like I always failed, because you would get these patients and it seems like for the duration of the transport, they did fine. And then as soon as we would set down on the helipad and I'm taking the elevator down to the unit or the ER, they would crash on me. And now I walk mm-hmm. in with this chaos and calamity in my hands, and the whole staff's like, who is this idiot? Every time they bring us a patient. But I finally had one of my medical directors say, Shane, you've got to understand when you're intervening in this continuum of care. Like, they recognized a problem. They called you. You're still in that discovery phase. And again, just like this right heart failure, it's like, it's going to present itself when it presents itself.
Yeah. And it's going to start this cascade of events, right? And so, and the problem is, I think, for many of us, and we have, when we've been on the receiving end of that, you didn't get to see when it started. So sometimes you're missing some of the key pieces of information that would have been super helpful if you were there and you watched them Brady down, right? Or if we actually had X-ray vision and could see, oh yeah, that septal wall is actually akinetic. Mm-hmm. It doesn't move.
Right.
It only looks like it's moving because one part of the heart is beating and the other part isn't. And so, yeah, it's, you have this cascade. And I also think in that situation, when you're describing, you're walking through the, like, you have used every compensatory mechanism that both the patient has and that you had available during transport. And that's why they fall apart as
right.
they go through
yeah.
the ICU, because
I'm
that's how
options.
Sick they are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you have a pump issue And you know, most of us don't walk around with an artificial heart pump in our pocket.
You never know, you know.
Someday it'll be in our watch. You just are like, you just click it.
That's right.
Instead of an EKG, you're going to be like, start pacing.
So where we're at today with right heart failure treatments, like it sounds like, you know, as history progresses and new technologies come around, we're starting to identify them early. And we've learned that that's a huge component to morbidity and mortality is just recognizing it sooner than later. Right. But when we look at how we treat it and our treatment options, are we moving in the right direction? Like, are we finding better and better things? Are we just using the same things we've used for years, but we're just using them sooner? Like, what does that look like?
I think it's both. I think we are finding new things. We have known for a little while now that the left heart, again, can recover. We didn't used to think that hearts could recover, right? That like if you had a heart attack or myocardial ischemia, that, you know, there was how it was going to be. And like a lot of times they used to just send patients home to like do nothing. Right. But now we know that that's a bad idea. And so now we know both that hearts can recover. And then we also know that there are things that we can do that help hearts recover. Some of us actually work for a company that help hearts recover. We don't even want that, even though we know that the left heart tolerates dilation, we don't want it to dilate, because that actually creates coronary perfusion issues, right? So that's bad. So we know that we want to unload that heart, even the left heart, right away, because it actually protects the heart from getting damaged even after whatever the insult that happened is over, right? So your ischemia could be fixed, but if your heart is still overloaded or dilated, you can still be having coronary damage and coronary ischemia, even if you've been revascularized, because your heart is too full. And so we know that that has to happen early. And what we also have learned, so historically, we all know that right heart failure was either A, not treated at all. That's why people used to be, they would die from congestive heart failure. That's basically what congestive heart failure is failure of the right heart. And then we kind of got to this generation where we treated it with just, I mean, industrial doses of drugs, right? And then we got really drugs and nitric. We used nitric to reduce kind of this pulmonary afterload as well. And so we got really good at pharmacologic or medical management of right heart, because that was the only option we had. And so we used to, you know, we used to talk about bringing these patients out of the OR on rocket fuel. Well, rocket fuel was nitric cranked all the way up, epi maxed out. You had several other things in line that you would just basically flip off and on to need it. And you would afterload the daylights out of them. So they would be on milrinone, epi, and nitric. That was like just the standard. And so now we still do that, but we do it prophylactically, right? So we do it again earlier. Like we come out of they still are going to come out of the OR like that, but they're going to come out on reasonable doses because we did it before they ever got dilated. But now we know too that all of that stuff has a limited ability to impact kind of our three, what I call the biblical things, you know, just like we know that the heart needs preload and afterload. But we also have this contractility piece. And so there's only so much that drugs can do to impact preload, afterload, and contractility. And once you have kind of maxed that out, you then actually need something else. And we have had left-sided devices for a while, and now we've had right-sided devices, but we weren't great at using them, and we didn't really know how early we needed to use them. And now we have really good devices. Like, for instance, the company that we work for has really good device. It can be deployed very early on because it's not super invasive. It can be taken back out. It doesn't require a sternotomy, right? You don't have to go on bypass to get it. And we know that if you unload that right heart, that essentially a very similar thing happens. That heart can actually get better and start to work on its own. And in the meantime, you're getting blood flow to the lungs and to the body and to the organs. And so people don't get this just 1-2 punch that they get used to get with a pump failure. Because you have all the downstream effects. If you have a pump failure, you have all the downstream effects from it. And that's what people used to die from, actually, if you think about it. People didn't die because their right heart wasn't working very well. They died because their right heart wasn't working well, and they drowned in their lungs.
Right. The sequela that followed. Right.
Yeah. That downstream effect. And so, yeah, it's both. We're smarter about it, and we know that we can't wait around.
You know, we reviewed this paper a little while ago, and this is beyond the scope of this conversation, so I'll keep it extremely general. But essentially, this study looked at patients who were transferred from a spoke facility to a hub facility, and it looked at their outcomes. And the two categories that this specific paper studied were patients who were having a STEMI and patients who were in heart failure. And again, high-level summary, but comparing those two groups, heart failure patients, STEMI patients, the time or delay in transfer was almost 3 times as longer in our heart failure patients, and they had an exponentially higher, worse outcomes. And kind of the conclusions of the authors were, and this makes sense, right? Like STEMI has such an acute and negative connotation to it that there's always this rush and there's excitement, you know, and we've had these metrics for forever, right? It's the door to balloon. It's the door to EKG. It's the, you know, we have all these things surrounding them, and those are pretty, protocolized, right? That's a word we'd like to use a lot in our world. But these heart failure patients, even though the word failure is in the name, it doesn't have that same emotional attachment to the providers because there are so many people that have the chronic version of it, right? Like you walk around all the time in heart failure, but you're not in extremis. You don't find people who go home and are like, oh, my STEMI's acting up today. Like, no, that's a different situation, right?
Right.
So I think even just the name, even just the diagnosis of heart failure, I think it's still too vague. It's still too esoteric.
It is.
And I know we're trying to get better, right? Like we've subcategorized the ones that have reduced EFs and preserved EFs. Like we're trying to get better, but even that still, I think, is such a moving target. And people have different interpretations of the treatment plans for that because it's not a one size fits all approach. Like if I'm in heart failure, what you do for the guy next to me in heart failure could be completely different based on the etiology of it, right?
100%. The other thing is okay, using the STEMI example is a great example is this guy woke up this morning, was fine, and now looks terrible, very acute. Heart failure, honestly, even if it's relatively newly developed or if you've had it for off and on for several years, these people because it's such an indolent process, right? And because it's around all the time and waxes and wanes, they don't tend to report some of the symptoms either, right? So they get used to being short of breath. They get used to having kind of a low exercise tolerance. They have gotten really used to being dizzy when they stand up.
Mm-hmm. No, I know.
Right. And so they don't tell you. And then, you know, I always use this. You get this little old lady and she doesn't complain anyway. Right. This is a 75-year-old that's still mowing her own lawn. She doesn't complain. They don't complain. I sat with these ladies in the cath lab getting their procedures, and they'll complain about a sore throat. And you're like, that's not a sore throat. You're having a heart attack. but so they don't complain. And so they don't have some of the typical milestones for us. And people in heart failure also don't have super normal vital signs.
Right. Yep. And the patterns are so hard to discern because they fit into that weird Venn diagram where they're atypically atypical, right? Because that is not a very predictable set of assessment findings or presentation. There's such a myriad of options that can present, you know, and this is another analogy that I'm going to throw back to the pediatric world. when I was providing for pediatrics, it would drive me insane when people would say, oh, well, peds will just compensate until they don't. And it's like, no. They've been trying to tell you, you just didn't know the clues to look for. And I think that's very relevant to these heart failure patients. To your point there, it's like, no, positional dyspnea, that's not normal, right? Your 2+ pitting edema is not something you're just expected to tolerate. But you get these little nuances of findings, and now you look at it, right? Like you can't see the forest through the trees kind of thing. And you're like, oh, no. You've been in heart failure for a long time.
Oh, you've been sleeping in the recliner for a week?
Right.
You're in heart failure.
Yeah.
And you've been in heart failure. And so again, as you know, for the context of this conversation, you should assume that patient for sure that they have right heart failure. Not only do they have a pump fail, they have a pump problem, and we don't know exactly what it is, right? You don't know. But you should assume that that patient has biventricular dysfunction at a minimum, and that anything that you can do, because they're still alive at this point, anything you can do is going to upset the homeostasis that they have managed to maintain until that time. And so then it goes back to, again, what you talked about earlier, this very careful titrated treatment, watch, you know, yep. You give them some oxygen. Perfect. Yep. Good. That didn't seem to change anything, didn't hurt anything, didn't make anything super better, but they look more relaxed. Great. Perfect. Give them, maybe they are having a STEMI, who knows, but gave them some pain medicine. They look a little bit better, not worse. Great. You started an IV and gave them a little bit of volume. Oh, they look bad. Like now they look more uncomfortable, more restless. Okay. No more volume for you, buddy.
So I think, Nancy, what we've done is we've effectively scared every transport provider that every patient is in heart failure that they're going to encounter, I think is what we're telling them, right?
Yeah. I mean, they know that. We didn't scare them. They all know that.
They all know that.
They know that. These guys, you can't scare these guys.
Yeah. They've seen it all,
they're
right?
Transport providers.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. All right. So in closing, have a low threshold or have a low tolerance for these weird symptoms that don't just quite add up. And if they don't, in the setting of a cardiovascular patient, we assume heart failure. Or better stated, we assume some degree of RV dysfunction. Let's put it there, right?
Correct.
Because the failure, it makes you think you're at that extremist side where you may not be yet, right?
And the dysfunction is where we want to intervene.
Sure. Absolutely.
Right. Again, if you get back to early, we don't actually want to get to failure.
You know, in all of these situations we're discussing have been kind of with the pretext that this is an arranged transport, like a spoke to hub transport. But we would be amiss to say that there are a lot of these patients that these transport providers will get from the scene with no prior care, with no prior diagnosis or diagnostics. And if you're in a position that you can influence your destination, then you take them to the most appropriate center. You know, and this is what I'm learning as I get into this role a little deeper is in healthcare, we've done a really good job in the pre-hospital department of doing this with trauma. You pick up a patient, you don't take them to the closest center, you take them to the closest, most appropriate. We did a really good job of this in neuro, with strokes, with LVOs, with all these presentations. You take them to the closest, most appropriate. We're not hitting the mark there with cardiovascular yet. We're working on it. There's a lot of campaigns and there's a lot of organizations that are now realizing the importance of this. But transport providers, if you have that patient and you have the opportunity to influence your destination choice, you take them to somewhere that has all the tools at their disposal, because the delay in definitive care is what really is going
to
get them.
Yeah. They need to go someplace with advanced therapies, right?
Yep. Right.
I think about that every time we go to our family cabin, which is 2 hours outside of, I'm like, there's no hope.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there's a helicopter nearby and I know a few people. So let me know when you get up there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Nancy, this was fun. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Thanks for listening to Inside Impella Transport Talks. We're here to support you in recovering hearts and saving lives. For more Impella Transport information, visit us at heartrecovery.com/transport. And if you like our podcast, please head to your favorite podcast platform to subscribe and give it a 5-star rating. This podcast is sponsored by Abiomed. The information, findings, and conclusions expressed are those reached independently by the authors.